From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Parent. An academic who was part of a Nobel Prize-winning campaign for a treaty against nuclear weapons says more needs to be done to help those dealing with the lingering effects of nuclear weapons testing. Matthew Bolton, who is the director of the International Disarmament Institute at New York's Pace University, says the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons requires rehabilitation and support for those affected. The treaty was signed by 122 countries last year, but none of the nuclear countries, including those who tested in the Pacific, have joined the treaty. Dr. Bolton recently traveled to Kiribati Island, where the British tested nuclear weapons, and says people are dealing with health and psychological effects from the tests, but have received little support. He told Jamie Tahana that with the countries that dropped the bombs doing nothing, other countries should fill the void.
There has been some compensation given to American veterans of the U.S. nuclear tests, and there has been limited compensation to some veterans elsewhere. But there's been very little help to the Kiribati people who were living on Christmas Island during the time of the tests. And they have pretty horrifying stories of their experiences during that time, and many of them attribute health problems that they have today to the testing. And many of their children and grandchildren also report health experiences that are consistent with having relatives exposed to ionizing radiation. And so one of the difficulties is that there hasn't been consistent monitoring of radiation levels. There was some studies done in the 70s and the 80s, but there hasn't been much follow-up. And so one of the things that we're trying to call on governments to help with is to help the people of Kiribati know better the situation that they're in, that there needs to be proper environmental kind of studies and public health kind of studies and monitoring that is ongoing and can give people the information they need.
So the locals there are experiencing what, higher rates of leukemia, similar with sort of other nuclear veterans or people who have been in similar areas? And what treatment do they have there? Because it's a very small hospital on Chris. You must have even have an oncology doctor or whatever.
So it's difficult to tell because there hasn't been sort of systematic data gathering. And that's one of the things that I think is really important, that there needs to be, you know, systematic assistance to help that information be gathered. So we're sort of identifying a gap. People themselves are reporting problems, but there hasn't been a kind of sufficient attention to helping them with that. And of course, as you point out, there isn't an oncology unit at the hospital on Christmas Island. People have to go to like Hawaii, or they have to go to New Zealand, but that's expensive and involves a lot of travel. If you're sick, you might not want to go that far, and it also involves a visa for some people, particularly going to the United States.
Yeah, so that lack of research into this must make it difficult for Kiribati in terms of claiming compensation or aid for this or whatever, when the countries that dropped the bomb continued to insist that it was clean and that every measure was taken to prevent this. Of course, we've argued sort of through various courts that these high rates of cancers and whatever can't be proven to be directly related to the nuclear tests.
Yes. So one of the things that the new treaty does, which I think is very helpful, is it takes the conversation out of a kind of litigation framing and into a humanitarian framing. And so rather than seeing this as a kind of fight in a courtroom over what exactly forensically happened and who is to blame for that, the framing is about how are people who were affected, how are they suffering, how are they coping, how can we support that coping, how can we assist them and give them the information they need. It isn't just about the effect of ionizing radiation. There's also a kind of psychological impact of having witnessed, you know, detonations, the kind of long-term anxiety of fearing what might be there waiting for you in your bloodstream, the kind of cultural trauma that this does, the harm to the land, the harm to the animals and the plants and your environment, and the sense that there has been this great trauma, not only to yourself, but also to your island and to your people. And what we're calling for is a framing of harm that is more expansive, more inclusive, and more humanistic than one that would be kind of found in a courtroom. And that means also because nuclear weapons, this treaty frames nuclear weapons as an affront to all of us, to an affront to the principles of humanity and our public conscience. And that means also then that it is the responsibility of all of us to address this. It's not just a problem of the victim and the perpetrator, but all of us who are people and who have a sense of humanity have an obligation to those who have been harmed in all of the ways that human beings and their environments can be harmed.
But should it not be a responsibility for the perpetrator that detonated these radioactive weapons to pay for the cleanup or the costs or whatever, which is what the Kiribati and Fiji veterans are arguing right now? Kind of, they're not even part of this treaty. They boycotted the negotiations for it, I guess, is it?
Yes. So absolutely, I mean, it should be on them to have a special responsibility to assist those that they have harmed. But in the same way that it's one thing to have something be written into a treaty, and it's another thing to make sure that it occurs. And so the research that we were doing in Kiribati and also Fiji, and talking with survivors, talking with associations, and talking with government officials who have been involved in trying to address this issue, we are trying to understand what can be done and to put some pressure and focus and attention on the harms that have been done and what needs to be done in the future. It's a scandal. It's a travesty that the deep-seated racism of Britain and the US and France imposed the costs of their nuclear programs on indigenous peoples and peoples that they had colonial control over. And now is the time to, I mean, it's always been the time, but now especially we have a kind of normative framework to deal with this. And so all of us need to chip in to try to help those who are in Kiribati, in Fiji, in French Polynesia, and Marshall Islands, that those places particularly have suffered the consequences of the kind of Cold War nuclear politics.
The subsidiary of a major Malaysian company has agreed in mediation and to renegotiate land deals in Papua New Guinea's East New Britain. Guildford Limited, which is wholly owned by Rembrandt Hidjo, has been in negotiation with landowners over the Sigrid Marcus project, with the assistance of the Catholic Archdiocese. The company, through a special agriculture and business lease, has been harvesting trees and planting oil palm trees for the last 4 years in four different areas, which together total 55,000 hectares. Work on a fourth area has not yet begun, but will soon. The Archbishop Francesco Panfolo told Don Wiseman the landowners got all they sought from the mediation.
We hope that something good will really come out of it. We managed to go through it, and I would say we got what we wanted somehow, and perhaps even more than what we wanted or we were expecting.
There's a lot to work through over a number of years here, and during that time, will harvesting of the trees continue?
I don't think so, because at this point in time, it's very clear. For example, there was one of the areas that is the Unum Sikita investment where they have never entered, and now that agreement was cancelled, and now the landowner of Unum Sikita, they'll be the one to make a proposal. So the ball is in the hands of the landowners now. Unfortunately, when we talk of the other three areas, there has been already logging, they have already planted a lot of oil palm, and so on and so forth. So there will have to be a renegotiation of the original agreement and sublease agreement that were made before. And that includes that there has to be transparency, there has to be proper communication, there has to be a review of the rental benefits, the royalties, the contribution to infrastructure and community development, things that were not present in the previous agreement. So that has to be done before the year 2020.
Is this the first time an SABL has been turned over?
So in its itself is something quite positive. It's quite positive because, as I said, what happened has happened. For example, another thing that is included in this mediation is the question of the environmental damage. We will have to see what exactly, because the mediation will continue and there will be some issues that might not be easy to resolve. The mediator is obliged to come into the picture. Mr. Craig Jones is very clear in the result of the mediation. So when the issue of environmental damage and so on will be discussed, is a negotiation, in other words. The important thing is that this cannot be denied anymore. It is part of the deal.
It's been a long and tough process for you, hasn't it?
Yes, a long and difficult process. And I will have to say also expensive, because we have to hire lawyers. And of course, the people there could not pay. So the Archdiocese came into the picture. We will see to it that we get all this through. By 2020, there has to be a renegotiation of the previous of the lease agreement. So there is still a lot of work to be done, because at this point in time, they have to organize themselves. And so this will be a process that we'll have to follow, and it will not be a simple work.
5 years ago, the United Nations General Assembly reinscribed French Polynesia on the decolonization list, but France still refuses to acknowledge it. At the same time, France is stooting plans for a strengthening Indo-Pacific zone, which it extends from Paris to Papeete. A leading pro-independence politician, Motai Brotherson, says he is against French Polynesia being turned into a pawn on a chessboard of the superpowers. He told Walter Zeifeld he wished France would respect the United Nations.
They're acting as if we were not put back on the list, which is a total nonsense and a kind of a schizophrenic posture, because they have two territories back on that list, New Caledonia and ourselves. And on one hand, they are at the table of discussions regarding New Caledonia. When the topic of New Caledonia is raised at the UN, they stay in the room, whereas whenever it comes to the topic of French Polynesia, they leave the room and then they come back afterward. You know, to us, it's a total disrespect, and we don't think it's a posture that they could, you know, adopt much longer. That's really the part that's missing. It's France coming to the table as an adult country, being respectful of the UN decision.
Do you have any idea why France would not attend discussions involving French Polynesia while honouring the process in relationship to New Caledonia?
So it's a little bit sad when you come down to the analysis of that, because I think that it all comes down to violence. We have been very proud and very glad to achieve our reinscription without any bloodshed, whereas in New Caledonia, as you know, more than 80 people died for that. So maybe the only language that France accepts to listen to, which would be a pity.
In today's situation, is there anyone or any country that is vocal about supporting your action and your activity?
The vast majority of the countries, members of the NAM, are very supportive, because they are all ancient colonies and they know what it is to be colonized, and they are very supportive of any decolonization process. And they increasingly don't understand why France is adopting the stance that they have been adopting since our reinscription.
President Macron was in Nouméa a couple of weeks ago, and he gave a speech outlining this new concept of the Indo-Pacific zone, and in his language it stretches from France via India, Nouméa, and also mentions Papeete. How do you feel about being part of something sort of strategic global?
We have long been conscious of our strategic position right in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. We are on the line from China to Brazil. You will find French Polynesia, and we are in the middle of what is nowadays the economic center of the world. So it comes to no surprise to us that Macron is realizing the importance of that. What is a little bit, I would say, disturbing to us is that we don't envision our future as a pawn for France, you know, geostrategic chessboard for France. We consider ourselves as a nation in building. Our goal is still independence, and we don't want to be used and abused by superpowers, any of them, including France.
How do you, from your vantage point in Papeete, feel about China's incursion as a soft power at the moment into the Pacific region?
We don't see China as an enemy or an adversary. We want to see China as a partner, as a possible partner in the future. But of course, we are very cautious of, you know, history taught and history learned, for example, in Africa, where we have seen bad examples, bad practices by China using natural resources of these countries, going from soft power to hard power in many of these countries when they come to have established strategic ties. So that's what we don't want to be in that position where, because we have welcomed China, we become, you know, we exchange one colonizer for the other. So we want to see China as a partner, and as a partner, we welcome it. But we don't want to be just another pawn. Used to be a pawn for France, and becoming a pawn for China or any other superpower is not on our radar.
How do you see, in this context, this huge project with Hao Atoll, which is, interestingly enough, also the place where there's a huge military runway?
What is envisioned nowadays by the current local government, we consider it a total nonsense from an economic standpoint as well as ecological standpoint.
And how is that?
Well, for example, they want to put, you know, more than 2,000 fish cages in one lagoon, in the lagoon of Hao, which is known to be polluted by radioactive waste, even though efforts have been made by France in the last few years to so-called depollute that lagoon, but it's still polluted. So to us, doing aquaculture in the lagoon of Hao is a total nonsense, because who wants to eat a fish that comes from a polluted lagoon? Also, the species that they want to cultivate are totally carnivorous species. So it takes 6 kilos of sardines from Argentina to raise 1 kilo of fish from the Hao aquaculture project, which is a total nonsense. One, killing the lagoon of Hao, and two, bringing it 6 times more fish from outside than the fish that we would produce from Hao, which is, you know, just crazy.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Tributes have been shared widely for renowned businessman and Samoa's first FM radio broadcaster, Maposua Rudolph Kelly. Maposua, who passed away at age 83, was the first to establish a commercially privately owned radio station and introducing an FM frequency in Samoa in the 1990s. This followed a decision by the then Prime Minister, Tofiao Etialisan, to amend the Broadcasting Act to open up the airwaves to radio stations other than the government's 2AP. Last month, Radio Polynesia, which is owned by the Masopo and his family, had sought the commercial of TV3 station in a joint venture with a local business partner. The Minister of Pacific Peoples in New Zealand was a close friend of him, and Apito Williams, CEO, says his friendship with the businessman began in Samoa during a protest.
It goes back to there was a period in 1992 when I was in Samoa, a period of change in Samoa, because the government of the day had such a huge majority. And there was a movement within the communities that majority was not a good thing. And then when that majority was used to change the constitution of Samoa and to reduce the term of a controller and chief auditor from a lifetime role into an appointed role for, I think, 3 or 5 years. Some of us were organized on the ground. I was the general secretary of a newly established trade union in Samoa, and also was on the Public Service Association as one of their education officers in Samoa. And therefore, there was a need to establish new political organizations to provide alternative views, to increase the quality, to raise the quality of political debates about where Samoa ought to go. And Maposua, even though he wasn't a political person, he supported that open, transparent debate around political issues. He felt it was good for Samoa. And even though he was, you know, the license for the operation of a radio station was very much dependent on the government of the day, he felt strongly that political organizations should have the opportunity to have open, transparent debate on political issues because that was important for all of Samoa. And so there was a newly established political party called the Samoa All People's Party, who didn't have any money, was sort of organized under the smell of an oily rag. He, Maposua, provided office space in his radio business building, and then he supported the running of debates on radio, the running of political adverts on the radio, which just gave voters an opportunity to be involved in an open, frank political debate leading up to the 1996 general election.
Tell us a little bit about the legacy that he leaves behind.
He was a businessman who had a social conscience. For me, he was a person that, as much as he had strong business interests, not just in Samoa, but in other parts of the Pacific, he also embodies, for me, the point of difference that I think our business people have. And that as much as he was generating an income from himself, from his business interests, he also had a particular interest to give back to the community. And I think he lived that by helping organizations such as the one that I just referred to, making sure that the future for Samoa was going to benefit all the peoples of Samoa.
A Samoan poet has published a heartfelt piece of poetry in motion on social media in response to her mother's residential care home subsidiary application being declined in New Zealand. She now faces a lengthy wait before she can reapply. Titled Dear Loyal New Zealand Citizen, Grace Taylor reads a letter on Facebook written to the Ministry of Social Development as a video plays of her mother slowly dancing the Samoan siva, or dance, wearing a traditional outfit. She says her mother has been unfairly treated given she has Alzheimer's and no direct family members in New Zealand to care for her. As her mother's power of attorney, she told Sara Viatulu that it flies in the face of all that her mother has done and contributed to New Zealand's economy as a hard-working Pacific migrant.
Dear loyal New Zealand citizen, thank you for your back-breaking, sleep-deprived, midnight shift dedication to our economy for the last 40 years. Thank you for your Samoan pride for not accepting a benefit when you became a single parent with two kids and a mortgage. Thank you for not complaining.
You know, I was fascinated by your decision or your choice to portray your story around poetry in motion. Can you tell us about why the visual and the dancing is very much a part of that narrative?
I've been a writer, a poet, and a performer for over 10 years now. And that particular footage for the video is recycled from a video that my mother and I made in 2013 with a good friend of mine, Jade Tamiti. And we made that video. It's called Tina, and it's actually three short poems that I have published in elsewhere. But it was the footage that my mum allowed, you know, agreed to be filmed with her, which is a big deal for my mum. She's quite shy of cameras. So I chose that footage because Siva is, for my mum, one of the things that she does that brings her the most joy, and it really does, and I wanted to show her in that element, but also put a face to, like, I want people that are in places of position where they can make legislation change to actually see this is the face of a person that your laws are affecting. Like, real people are behind your decision. And so I just wanted to put a human element into the hard stuff.
In honour of your loyal dedication and faithfully paying your taxes for the last 40 years. When your disease takes over and you require medical support every day, we hereby grant you nothing. We grant you punishment for 40 years of dedication. We grant you access to a care home you need that broke your children's hearts to admit you into. But don't worry, everything you need to keep you physically alive is there. It only costs $1,050 a week. We grant your children this cost. We are certain your single mother daughter that doesn't get a benefit can handle this, just like you did.
I didn't even plan to write it. I don't actually, as a writer, I don't like writing when I'm in the midst of like the hard stuff that I'm going through. But I have a lot of anger and a lot of heartbreak about this whole situation, and me writing that was unplanned, and it just came out because I, as a human being, I needed to just get it out of my system because I couldn't do the things I need to do as a daughter without getting that out of that energy out of my system. And so that's why I wrote it.
It's about your journey at this particular time. What's your last words in relation to other people going through similar struggles?
Don't be silent. Don't be afraid to question decisions and question laws and legislation. Whilst there is actually nothing that can be done, like in terms of the decision that's been made for my mother and for many others, we can advocate for some sort of change. And me doing this is the catalyst for that, because once my family situation is sorted, I will be petitioning publicly for this to be going to government and wanting the legislation to be changed, the 5-year stand-down period and everything for this residential subsidy. Because there's no point bringing to voice and advocating, but then not following through with trying to actually make change happen. And that is something I do intend to do. And for anyone out there that does have any family that has had the same story as me, join me when it does happen. It's so important to ask questions. Don't take the final letter as the final word.
That's something a lot of Pacific people struggle with.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I've been navigating this journey with my mom for 2 years now, and it's taken me 2 years as a daughter of a Samoan woman to be able to allow the outside help and support for my mum, like the fact that my mother is even in a care home. That's heartbreaking for me to do. There's a lot of guilt and grief, especially as a Samoan daughter, to do that, to admit your parent into care home. And it's something I really struggled with, especially about, you know, our way of our Samoa. You know, I had a lot of support, but I know people do kind of look at me sideways like, but you're Samoan, like you look after your parent. But when it's just you, like, I don't have my family village around me. It is literally just me at home and my son, you know, being a single mum as well. And there's just so much more. As a Samoan person, you know, not being in Samoa, not having that village around me, having to redefine what village actually is. So for me, my village is definitely my brother, but he doesn't live in New Zealand. And my village is mostly my friends. And that's just truth, but having to refigure what village actually looks like for you as a Pacific person away from your own motherland, yeah, is something that you have to do. And there is guilt attached to that. Well, there is for me.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. We hope to see you again very soon. We'll see you in 7 days' time. Bye-bye and have a good weekend.